For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I just hate to pot that down because that music is so fun and that guitar playing is just magical. It's by one Norman Brown, Grammy Award-winning Norman Brown, from his debut album, Just Between Us, the title track. Norman Brown is the headliner for Saturday's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Fest here in Kenosha, taking place at Celebration Place. And I'm very excited to be able to spend the opening minutes of today's morning show talking with Norman Brown about his wonderful career in music and what people can expect from his performance coming up in Kenosha this Saturday night. Norman Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. What's up, Wisconsin? Pleasure to be here with you.
Well, we're recording this Tuesday morning, and most of Wisconsin's pretty soggy from a rainy yesterday. But I was just looking at the forecast, and looks like Mother Nature is going to really cooperate nicely, giving us plenty of sunshine on Saturday, and actually a warm day. So the best place to be for all kinds of reasons will be right along the lakefront for the Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. And Norman Brown, I'm really, really pleased to speak with you. I really love your music and deeply admire your playing, and I'm excited to kind of hear a little bit more about you. My understanding is that you were born in Shreveport, Louisiana, but actually grew up in Kansas. Can we start there with the move from Louisiana to Kansas and a little bit about what your childhood was like?
Man, I'll tell you what. Here's my first memory pretty much in life. I'm on a tricycle. I think I'm like 3 years old. And my father had moved to Kansas City for a job opportunity. And he come down and visit us on the weekend. He's getting ready to leave and go back to Kansas City. I'm 3 years old, and I'm losing my mind because I want to go with him. I'm driving this tricycle down this street, chasing my father in this car. And I remember this. He stops. My mother and everybody runs out to the middle of the street, grabs me, pulls me back. My daddy bags up. And, man, he had tears in his eyes. And I'll tell you what, Greg, the following weekend, all eight of us, my mom and my dad, are driving back to Kansas City.
Wow.
Yes. That's my earliest memory. It touched me that deeply. And now the second memory is riding on that ride from Louisiana to Kansas City, 3 years old, and I'm in the back seat sitting on my older sister's lap, and I'm playing with his ear along the way in his car. That was the beginning of my journey from Louisiana to Kansas City.
Fantastic. Love it. So tell us what the household was like in which you grew up, and to what extent music was a really important part of it all. I mean, were you growing up in a house full of music and amongst others who loved music?
Yes, it was exactly like that. My mother walked around the house singing Mahalia, but she loved B.B. King. My father loved Wes Montgomery and Grant Green, the jazz stuff. And then, of course, my siblings, they were into all the 70s music, Kool and the Gang, Earth and Frampton, and so on. So on the weekends, it was you know, part music night in the house. Records all over the floor and neighbors over, and this was just around music like that. And I'll tell you, it was like that in my neighborhood, pretty much a four-square radius block of just music-loving people, man. On the street, dancing in the summertime. It was so beautiful. Greg, I remember across the street was a family. They had a band. They had a bass player, a keyboard player, a whole band. They're playing on the weekends. Next door was a single father with a drummer son that played. Mother played. Now, I got hip to all this at about 8 years old, coming home one day, football, and it's at evening time, and all these people around my house, and it looked like a block party. I go inside, my brother is sitting there playing this guitar with a drum and a bass player. Let him step in the living room. Now, mind you, I shared a room with this guy for 8 years at that point. I had no idea he played guitar.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I see this, and I'm mesmerized. I sit down on the couch, and I stare at him until this is over, and I watch all these people around me. They're just dancing and smiling. Again, it feels so good. It just struck me inside the head. I said, man, I want to make people feel good like that. And where does he keep that guitar?
So tell us how you started learning the guitar in earnest. I mean, who were your first teachers? Or at the outset, were you kind of teaching yourself?
So at the end of that night, I watched to see where he's going to keep this guitar. He goes to our room, goes to that same closet I've been getting my shirts out of for 8 years, and he tucks this guitar case away, leaves and go plays with his buddies. I immediately grabbed this guitar case, sit on my bed, I opened it up, and it was like the heavens opened up. So I would sneak and play this guitar every night when he was gone, hanging out with his teenage friends. I did this for about a year, trying to learn how to play like Jimi Hendrix or Peter Frampton or any of these guys. And he came in one day, and he busted me. And I'm sitting on the bed with his guitar, and he walks in the room. I go, wow, man, I'm sorry. I didn't break it. You know, I just wanted to play it, you know. He goes, man, I didn't know you wanted to play. Play me something. I started trying to play some Jimi Hendrix. My brother, Popsicle, we called him, Roy Brown Jr., said, you can play it anytime you want to play it. And went to bed. That gave my journey with the guitar.
Wow. Very good. So, was it a love affair that was pretty much uninterrupted and unchallenged by other things? I mean, I'm just wondering, at some point, did you also want to start, you know, playing baseball or getting a chemistry set? Or, I mean, were there other interests that kind of threatened to kind of pull you away from the guitar? Or has it had pretty much an unyielding hold on you for all this time?
It had an unyielding hold on me for that time. I had other interests. I did. I was pretty athletic. Sports was fun and stuff, but I only saw it as fun. I loved to draw, and I was good with, you know, any subject pretty much that I was interested in. But this guitar thing, man, was incredible. You know, I started learning, and I started learning to play a little bit. Like I said, this whole little area I lived in Kansas City, Kansas, was just... There was a club down the street on the corner with a band playing every weekend. Around the corner was a family. I knew one of the younger sons. They had it was two sets of twins and a set of triplets. So they were a gospel group. This is one family. You know, down the street. I mean, this was an incredible where I grew up like this. So I continued on. I kept playing this thing. And my father realized I was good at it, and he challenged me to come to the basement and listen to Wes Montgomery. He put on Wes Montgomery, and it changed my life. And I started, and he said, well, you know what? You learn to play this, man, and I'll show that you use the car on Saturday night. And I started learning these West Montgomery songs for him. He would sit there and listen to me practicing, learn. I'd play with the neighborhood guys. I eventually got into a band with some of the local high school students, and we would play the Cyclops, they called them. And it was, these were parties at the local high school in Virginia. I split those, and I was just a young kid playing this guitar. And, it, you know, and from there, it just never stopped. I remember sitting in my classroom going from elementary school to junior high. So I'm in the fifth grade now, and I'm going to the seventh grade. So you got to choose these classes that you want to take, and you got to what you want to do in life. I'm sitting there going, wow. I'm looking at my artwork. I drew cars and all this stuff, and I was pretty good at it. I'm thinking about, you know, I was going to work out with the football team this summer so I could play next year in junior high school football. And music came to mind, and the world stopped. Time stopped, and everything stopped. Think of nothing in the world that felt better, that seemed natural, and that I loved more than playing the guitar.
Mm.
And I made a mumble. I said, okay, I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to take music classes.
Mm. We're speaking with guitarist Norman Brown, the headliner for this weekend's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Fest here in Kenosha. So he's going to be performing Saturday night. So my understanding is you make the trip to Hollywood to enroll in the Musicians Institute there. So at that point in time, was your family still based in Kansas? So in other words, were you traveling halfway across the country for this next chapter in your life?
Absolutely. I went to junior high school, I'm playing in bands, worked my way up to playing in, you know, the professional town by the time I was in high school. And, you know, I'm graduating, and I got to figure out, you know, talk to my counselors. They were like, well, I don't know, man. What do you want to do? Why don't you, you know? So I said, okay, I want to take care of my life. I'm going to go to Kansas City, Kansas Business College and study accounting, and I'm going to keep playing these gigs on the weekend. Because I've really been making good money. I'm, you know, one of the top guys around town by then. I'm able to have my apartment, you know, playing gigs on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And so I went to Kansas City Business College, started studying accounting. And it was great. It was fascinating. I'm glad I did it. I had a, you know, I learned a skill that I can use now. But a year into it, I said, man, what are you doing? You can't stay here. You have to leave. You have to get out of here. Now, this brother that had started me playing, and everyone around me, my family, my friends, my schoolmates, my teachers, everyone around me told me, you're going to make it, Norman. You have a great skill, and you got to make it. You're going to make it. You're going to make it. So I'm thinking, damn, I got to do it for all these people. All these people believe in me so much. I got to do it for them. So my brother invested in this beautiful professional guitar. He grew on up and got a job. He passed away at a young age in a car accident. And Greg, he was inheritance, so to speak, that allowed me to do what he told me to do, which was go to California.
Hmm.
He was going to take me to California and put me on this Gong Show.
Wow.
So he had me watching I'm watching the Gong Show every day after school to get ready for this journey. And he has a terrible accident. And, you know, leaves me this money. I buy professional equipment, guitars, amplifier, a car, and saying, go to California, man. You got to get to California. And I did. I enrolled in the Music Institute. And, man, I went to California. And I went to GIT. I studied for a year, graduated, became an instructor. And the journey had begun.
So I have a feeling part of the legacy of this incredible support given to you by so many people, but especially this beloved brother, is that you have not taken one single thing for granted since. I mean, in a sense, it put on your shoulders a sense of responsibility to try to make the most of this wonderful talent with which you had been blessed.
Exactly. Precisely. That's exactly what happened. It was a responsibility, I felt. And, you know, there was what I was to think was a derailment along the way. You know, I went to the prom. At this prom, you know, as young kids, you're supposed to have sex for the first time. So I'm with my girlfriend, and we do this, and I become a father, and I'm 15. I'm thinking to myself, man, it's a wrap. You've messed up now. You really messed up. There's thing is more important than you being a father. I had a wonderful set of parents. My mother and father was absolutely fabulous for the eight of us. And so it was like priority. I'm going to be a father now at 15. I'm saying, wow, this is pretty incredible. Told my dad, instantly told my mother. But it came to my mind that what would I tell this kid to do that I'm going to be a father? And how would I take care of this kid? And what was I going to do with this great... I had seen this gift of mine touch people already. I had seen this. I had experienced this. So it's like, okay, I can do two things in life. I can become one of the world's greatest guitarists so that I can be one of the world's greatest fathers.
So tell my mind, Greg. So tell us about the experience and the challenge of trying to do all that and balancing all that. No small matter.
Dude, this is incredible for me. You know, luckily I had the support that I had, a great family. And look, and this girlfriend of mine, I said to her, listen, we have to get married. We're about to be parents. She goes, we're 15. I don't want to get married. No, get married. I'm like, but that doesn't make sense. We're supposed to get married, you know? She says, no, we're not doing this. I remember walking her home to her parents, explaining to them, you know, I apologize for this or whatever, and that I'm going to be here to help raise this child for sure. I'm just going to do this. The parents say, normally we know you, and we know this. Okay, so I do my best. I'm working these gigs. Anytime I have, I'm picking up this baby and, you know, being this young father and gigs and practicing and learning my guitar. Now it's time to go to California. I'm in a quarantine. I'm going, dang, I can't leave, you know. I'm a father. I have to go. I spoke with my son's grandmother. And she told me, you have to get out of here. You have to go. She said, I'm going to be very disappointed if you don't go. Your son is covered. We got him covered. Between your parents and us and his mom's here, you have to go to California and do this. You have something special for the world. Man, I'm standing there in tears. And this happened on Boulevard after I went to audition for this Musicians Institute to get prepared to move there and making this decision. And I was like, damn, I can't leave my child. She told me, no, Norman, you can't do that. You have planted a seed with this young boy, and he's going to need you later in life. You have to be a ready man and able yourself to be able to do this. Greg, I tell you, man, it's a seriously challenging but rewarding journey, man. And all this is what you hear in this music that comes through me. I can see myself standing on Hollywood Boulevard on his payphone, being lectured by my son's grandmother, warning me, if you go to Kansas City, I'm going to pick you up myself and put you on a plane and take you back there to California. You know, you have to do this. And I did, man. I did.
We're speaking with guitarist Norman Brown, and I want to play a little bit more music and then continue our conversation. I'm going to play just a few moments from a really wonderful song that's called Paradise from, I think, one of your earlier albums. Can you just say a quick word about this song, and then we'll just listen to a little bit of it?
Paradise. This is a beautiful song written by myself and Paul Brown. It debuted on the Just Chillin', which is the Grammy Award-winning, produced by producer Paul Brown, featuring Rick Braun on the flugelhorn. This is Paradise. paradise, Sonoma Brown.
All right.
For you.
All right. Here's a little bit of it. Here we go. Boy, I defy anybody to listen to that and not just be beaming from ear to ear. I know that I am. It's just music that makes you feel good. The song Paradise, and on the guitar, Norman Brown, my morning show guest today. He's going to be headlining Saturday's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Fest. So, Norman Brown, tell us a little bit about the experience of creating albums in the studio versus performing in front of audiences. And to what extent are those really different endeavors for you, or does it really feel like the same thing? Just in one of those, there's an audience there. I mean, does it feel like a different kind of music making, one versus the other?
Absolutely, it does. It took me a while to get used to the studio. I grew up performing. I've been performing since I was, 10 years old. My father had to get me a permit to be able to go play in his clubs at 10. And when I got to the studio to make that first record, Mr. Keenis, produced by the great Norman Connors, this was for Mojazz, Motown's very first jazz label. I was the first artist. They're launching this label. They're launching my career. Love these tunes I have and this music. I'm in the studio learning to make a record with Norman Connors. And, man, I'm going to tell you, I didn't know where to find the magic. It was kind of like it was sterile. I had these headphones on. The guitar didn't sound like I wanted it to sound. I couldn't hear the air between the music. I get head on. I felt so caged in and almost suffocated. And one day, man, I looked at this red light when they turned on the tape recorder, and I saw the people. I said, damn, there they are. There's the people right there. So I would position myself in the studio to only see that red light. And when the engineer would hit record button, and the red light came on, I had an audience. So I felt like I was on stage then. That's how I made the connection.
Fantastic. What a great story. Love that. I love that. Over these many years, these decades now that you have been doing this, we should mention your debut album, Just Between Us, I think came out back in 1992. So you've been at this a long, long time. Over the course of those years, have there been things about this life that have, in a sense, kind of weighed you down? Or been a source of kind of frustration or difficulty, or by and large, has this felt completely natural and, for the most part, positive in every way?
Greg, let me say this, man. you are a documentarian, dude. You're hitting all the points. These are fantastic questions.
Great.
Yes, absolutely, my friend. Starting from, you know, now the journey to get into the business we call paying dues. And that's one of the hardest, you know, parts of this journey. Paying dues, getting skills together and playing these dives, playing all this, you know, playing music you may not like and all of this stuff. You think that was something. Oh, no. Wait till you get to the business side of it. Now, here I am, I'm Norman Brown, recording us. This is his name. People want to see me play around the world. I have to fly there to get there. I had never flown on an airplane. This was a new experience for me.
Hmm.
And then learning how the business works. You know, you have these managers, you have these agents, you have this publishing, you have your record company. Then you got promoters. You got this marketing and advertising that you're interested in. So this first record, I'm not knowing what is going to happen. And so we make this record. Motown puts together this label, this whole big conglomerate thing, sign these artists. The record is done. The label is ready. They have this big launch party, Santa Monica Airport in Santa Monica, California. Puts me in this hangar in a helicopter. Big, huge party. Billy Dee Williams hosting and all these stars. I'm flying into this hangar in a helicopter. I'm going to jump out. My music is playing. I got a band on stage. I jump up there, and I play for all these people. I'm going, this is incredible. This is pretty incredible right here. Okay, now the tour. The record goes out there. I got to support this record. And my managers have to understand what this means. Oh, promotional dates, go to record stores, go to radio stations, interview, and then play a concert in these cities back to back. Wow, this is incredible. So, man, I'm going to tell you, I would get on the plane, hit a city that morning, get off the plane, go do the morning radio show, come from there, hit the local record store, stand around and greet fans, you know, kind of thing, maybe get some lunch, go back to another radio interview that afternoon, leave there, go to a record store, greet some fans and kind of thing, go to sound check, and then maybe get some food and go play a concert that evening. After the show, I'm back to the hotel room, and I got to go to bed because I got another flight at 6 a.m. to get ready to go to the next city. That was incredible for me. I'm like, damn, this is something else, and I'm doing this in every city like that. I said, okay. Now, that's after learning about publishing because I'm writing all the songs, making a publishing deal, what's best for me, and the record deal and the business side of things. And I'm going, this is incredible, man. I've never seen anything like this. My father was a welder, and my mother, you know, made home. The most successful person I'd ever seen was maybe a manager at UPS kind of thing. This was incredible, living this journey like that, you know, and learning along the way.
Wow.
Business, etiquette, you know, travel, social, and then being an artist. I remember going to Africa for the first time. I thought I was Michael Jackson. I landed in the airport. There's this group of people here with my CD yelling and screaming about me, and this blew my mind. That was something to get used to, all in one kind of snapshot moment like that. Yeah. That would weigh pretty heavy. Now, I'm young, and it's great, and yes, I'm eager to go. Keep going. Dang, it's like, wow. The work part is traveling. I really love the stage part, but my goodness, to get there and to get to the next one became the way down.
Hmm.
And to this date, that is the part that I'm least fond of. I enjoy COVID. Not having to fly on an airplane for 2 years.
That break was okay, huh?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about another facet of what you do, which I don't think we've yet really explored, and that's the whole business of composing and arranging and so on. And of course, often when it comes to composing in the field of jazz, we're talking about something that's a little different than if you sit down and compose a string quartet or something. And I mean, we're talking about notating every single note and kind of mapping things out. And of course, by and large, music in the realm of jazz tends to take shape a little bit differently. How does it typically take shape for you? What is usually the process by which you create a brand new song for the world?
Well, you know, I had no idea about how to compose, how to write, those things. I was a natural player. Now, I played saxophone throughout junior high and high school so that I could be part of the music program because, of course, they didn't teach guitar in school. Hmm. And fortunately, I was able to play guitar, though, because my teacher was wise enough to put together a jazz band. So we actually had jazz band, and I played guitar. So that was the extent of my music theory that I learned, how to read music. It was on saxophone and upright bass in an orchestra. And so each year we would go to these NAJE, National Educators Jazz Association, competitions. It starts on the regional level, then it goes to the city level, then it goes to the state level. You know, and I would win these competitions, you know, each of these 3 years on upright bass for the symphonic orchestra, on saxophone, I mean for the orchestra, on saxophone for the symphonic orchestra, and then, of course, on guitar for the jazz band. And we would go to these camps in Wichita, Kansas, the state capital, and I was doing these things for the NAE. That's how I started learning to read and get into the theoretical side of things. I'm graduating, it's time to learn. I want to learn more about how to theoretically compose and orchestrate, arrange, and these kind of things. Read music better and, just theoretically. So I'm looking at colleges. I go to this music camp my senior year. There's a man named Jack Peterson, who is a great guitar teacher for the North Texas State Jazz Department. This is one of the highly recommended schools, highly acclaimed schools for jazz musicians in the world, in my opinion. They had something called a guitar ensemble, which was, a big band, 18-piece big band, but all guitarists.
Wow.
So there was six guitars playing saxophone parts. There were six guitars playing trombone, the brass parts. There were six guitars, playing, in the back there. Then you had the rhythm section. I was fascinated with that, man. And I'm at this camp with this guy who runs this program. Now, this is how bad these musicians were. They had a jazz band for every hour of the day. So the baddest band was the 1 o'clock band. And then they had the 12 o'clock, the 11 o'clock. All these bands were 1 o'clock. I wanted to go to this school so bad. I got to spend this weekend summer camp with this teacher, and no other guitarist was there. It was he and I one-on-one. And, man, I insulted him. I'm listening to him. He's bragging on one of these ensemble bands. I'm listening to these guitar players play, and they all sounded the same to me. And it blew my mind. And I said, Mr. Peterson, these guys, they all sound the same. They don't sound like Wes Montgomery or, Greg Green or some of these guys. He says, what? He says, listen, this is how you learn. Man, he read me my rights. And I said, wow, okay, I get it. I tried to get a scholarship, did not get one. And so I did not get to go to that school, North Texas State University. KU University, Kansas State University, offered me its full ride scholarship. Come here with us, man. We'll get you a car bed and an apartment, and we'll take care of you. I'm going, great. Oh, this is great. So now I'm saying, what am I going to do after this? I'm talking to my band director in the 12th grade, Mr. Martin Dunlap, who comes into the school. My 10th grade year, it freaked out this program, which was horrible. They would go through like six band teachers in a year. The kids were unruly. It's 12. I get there in the 10th grade. He gets there. He cleans up this music program. That began my journey on learning music theory. I'm so interested in all this. We're driving back from this festival, this NAJE jazz competition. He's taking me home this Sunday after this camp. And I'm going, Mr. Dunlap, I don't know what to do, man. You know, KU wants me to come there and get a scholarship, but, you know, I don't want to be a music teacher. And if I go there, I'll get a degree, and all I can do with that is be a professor. And I don't know what to do. You know, what would you do? And he says, well, you know, what would you want to do? Finally, he pulls the car over. He says, Norman, let me tell you something. He said, man, if I played like you, I would learn me a little bit more music theory and get out there. He said, you have to get out there, man. You got to learn some more theory, but you got to get out there. I said, wow. This guy was so structured. I was shocked to hear him say that. I'm thinking he's going to for sure say, go to KU, take the scholarship, get your degree, you know, go ahead and get your doctorate and this kind of thing. He says, no, man, the way you play, you have a great chance of speaking to the world musically. Get out there. Learn some more music theory, but get out there. I found this GIT school, music school, like a technical program bookstore in Hollywood, and that's where I went one year.
You know, I love that advice. I mean, I think a lot of times people think it's all or nothing, like go to school year after year after year after year, do all of this sort of book learning and so on and get on that path. And this advice given you strikes me as very wise advice, that you have some stuff to learn, but it doesn't have to be forever. It doesn't have to take forever. And just beyond that, beyond this short stint of study, is going to be a long and wonderful life as a musician. And, of course, that's what's turned out. My understanding is not long after you finished studying at the Musicians Institute, you taught there, and you taught there for a while. What did that feel like to kind of shift gears? Or did you work at the Musicians Institute in some other capacity?
Isn't that ironic? I'm telling him I didn't want to go to KU and take the scholarship because I don't want to be a teacher. Okay. And I end up going to this music school. I graduate, and I look around me. I need a job. And this is such a, how can I say, flexible, beautiful program. You know, they encourage the instructors to be performers, and go out and play. And the style I played, you know, this school didn't really have that on their faculty in terms of, you know, a West Montgomery kind of prodigy in this style. And, you know, so I graduated, and what am I going to do now? I'm going to guess, you know, I go to, I need a job, man. Can I be a teacher? Yeah, you know, so, wow, Norman, I was thinking exactly. They started me off as a private instructor, gave me a few students, like, twice a week, and I worked my way all the way up to I became a full-fledged instructor, and I wrote curriculum, and, you know, I taught there for 13 years. That was when I learned to compose. It was. Graduate studying, it's really a cram course. It's 4 years worth of learning. It's intense. And I'm studying harmony, chords, substitution, how this works. In learning that, I started hearing, you know, vibes and seeing colors and feeling textures with these chords. So I'm putting these chords together, and it's a game. You know, the structure came naturally for me. And I would just try anything. You know, diatonic harmony, for example, is staying in the key. And I would say, man, that sounds reciprocal. How can I break that? And then I would think about substitutions and you know, try some other stuff. And, you know, man, break all those rules. Get those rules. Play what sounds good. And I started putting these chord progressions together, and I love improvising. But then I would get a little structure, maybe a four-bar pattern, and improvise over it. In doing that, I would find something that I would play that would, you know, I could sing or that would stand out to me. I would take that little section out, develop it into a melody over those four chords, and I said, man, this is the song. I said, well, what is it missing? Structure. Intro, verse, chorus, bridge. Musical improvisational room. And I was like, damn. And I thought about it like this, man. I said, how does this relate to life? I said, wow, the intro is kind of like, okay, you get introduced to something. It's the first time you see an idea, an item, a scenario, situation, event, whatever. And, you know, you got to get a look at it, walk around it, see what it is, and you go, okay, I'm going to learn what this is about. Then the verse happens. The verse is explanatory. Oh, these are the wheels. Here's the body. There's the door. Drive shaft. Rear end. Transmission. Engine. Turn steering wheel. I said, damn, that's the verse. This other little section would come, and it would be like a little interlude kind of thing. And I found this is a summary of the explanation. So it's called a pre-course. That's a thing. Then I get to the course, and the course is like, this is a car. This is a blue car. This is a Ford, 1987, blue Ford, you know, whatever. That's the hook. I said, damn, this is how songs work.
I have not ever heard those. That's, what a great image, and I can see how it made perfect sense to you. And wow, I love that. You're listening to an interview with guitarist Norman Brown, the headliner for this year's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival coming up this Saturday in Celebration Park down at the Kenosha Lakefront. I'm sad to say that that's all we hear from Norman Brown today. We were having a conversation over Mr. Brown's cell phone, and the signal began to fade. And despite our best efforts, it was just impossible for the conversation to continue from there. I asked him about what people could expect from Saturday night's concert, and I could glean even through the broken signal that what he was saying is that he chose jazz because there's this framework. But within that framework, anything can happen. And so he plans to adjust on the fly, depending on kind of the setting and the audience and the atmosphere and the mood. And but he promises a wonderful time for everybody who is there to hear him perform. So we're going to finish out by actually hearing a piece in its entirety that I really like a lot. This is called Up and Atom. And it comes from Norman Brown's 2004 album, which is called West Coast Coolin'. So here it is to finish out the morning show today. The great Grammy Award-winning jazz guitarist, Norman Brown. Thank you. Grammy Award-winning guitarist Norman Brown. He is the headliner for this year's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Fest. So everything takes place at Celebration Park down on the Kenosha Harbor. The gates open at 12 noon. The popular cooking studio will open up at 1:45, and all of the music will follow shortly thereafter, culminating in a performance by Norman Brown, 7:30 p.m. And if you would like more information about this year's festival, one of the best things you can do is go to the website mahonefund.org to learn more about the Mary Lou and Arthur H. Mahone Fund, which is the organizing sponsor for this great event. My thanks again to guitarist Norman Brown for being my guest today on The Morning Show here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, John Eisenberg talking about his fascinating book called The Streak. The Streak examines one of the most venerable records in Major League Baseball, the record for most consecutive games played. And for several decades, that record was held by the immortal Lou Gehrig. John Eisenberg's book is an examination of all of the great players chased Lou Gehrig's record in vain, and of how finally Cal Ripken Jr., was able to accomplish that extraordinary feat. The book is called simply The Streak. That will air tomorrow on The Morning Show. This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, a couple of gems from the archives, including Mary Pfeiffer and her wonderful book called Letter to a Young Therapist. And on Sunday, for sci-fi fans, a conversation with Mark Cushman talking about his very entertaining book about the series Lost in Space. That program aired for 3 seasons and was a very interesting counterpoint to Star Trek, the original series, which aired roughly